Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Father Daniel, welcome back. I understand
Chris, great
you had
to see
a,
you again.
Nice to see you. You were at a Regnum Christi retreat this past weekend.
Well, it wasn't exactly a retreat. It was a men's convention. So we had about 250 men from all across the United States joined together up in Cumming and had a really wonderful event. Great speakers, really good insights. Just anytime you get that many Catholic men together, it's an awesome experience.
Great. We'll start this week's show. And we're going to talk about a piece similar that we had done a couple weeks ago. So remember when we did the piece about how humans compare on the monogamy scale with other mammals?
Vaguely, yes. I have a really good talent for forgetting things. That's why I'm a priest. I hear confessions.
You're like a goldfish.
Well, not as bad as a goldfish. Come on.
All right. The National Review is out with a piece entitled The Polyamory Delusion. The article focuses on a book called Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. This book was published 15 years ago, and it promotes the idea that humans are naturally suited to polyamory, which is the practice of engaging in multiple romantic relationships simultaneously with the consent of all parties involved.
Mm-hmm.
Polyamory isn't quite the same as polygamy, but it rhymes with it. So proponents cite the long-standing assertion that humans are closely related to chimps and bonobos, and they point to the fact that these species aren't monogamous to legitimize their belief that humans need not be either.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with this argument is twofold. One, chimps are not made in the image and likeness of God.
True.
And number two, a definitive new study was published this past April in an article in the magazine Nature, where 123 geneticists working with the National Institutes of Health compared the genetics of six ape species. It turns out that humans aren't, in fact, as closely related to chimps as the regularly cited 98.6% figure that we probably
have
all
heard. Past, right?
According to the study, we share only about 85% of our genomes with these apes.
Interesting.
While monogamy is key to our survival, it's important for males to participate right in the rearing of our children. That makes it key to our survival. So if you're looking at this at the just in a secular scientific way, one of the incentives for monogamy is that infidelity leads to divorce,
right,
which leads to potential replacement of a biological parent for a non-biological one,
which and brings a whole slew of problems with it.
Right. And so according to a study published in the Child Abuse and Neglect Journal in 1984, stepfathers were eight times more likely than biological fathers to molest the stepdaughters they were raising.
Right.
Looking at it another way, there's a different take on monogamy that's emerged since the emergence of legal gay marriage. Anthropologists had wondered whether legalization might produce high divorce rates among gay men versus gay women, since it's taken for granted that men are more promiscuous than women.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out the opposite. Divorce rates are more common for lesbians than for
right,
gay men, and it's not an American phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Between 2005 and 2009, lesbian divorce rates in Belgium, Sweden, and the Netherlands were twice that of gay men. And Great Britain's, and according to a report in 2019 in Great Britain, divorce was three times more common among lesbians versus gay men. So, what are your thoughts generally about these two different, you know, things that we're talking about here: the gay divorce and the polyamory delusion?
Yeah, I think that you bring up a lot of really interesting points. We could talk the whole show about just this topic, but with regard to the higher rate of divorce among lesbians, I've heard also cited in other studies that oftentimes it is the women who initiate divorces because they are that, you know, kind of short term, the pain of a certain moment, a particular difficulty, they're not seeing the longer term. And I've just anecdotally over the past year, I've had four different men whose wives have come up to them and said, I want a divorce. And the men are just destroyed. It's really difficult for them. And they're not blameless in the situation. I mean, they were just, you know, not taking care of their relationship, not making their wife feel loved, etc. But at the same time, they're devastated by the divorce. And so because they're seeing longer term, they're not thinking of the shorter term.
Well, bring this back to polyamory and polygamy, though.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I found was that the plausible reason for lesbian divorce being higher than gay men divorce is that 43% of lesbian couples report either no sex or just once a month versus the heterosexual couples saying 16%. So lesbian couples are apparently tending to become asexual,
mm-hmm.
right? So let's relate this back to the initial topic.
But that also corresponds, I mean, with just the natural way that women approach sex. Sex for them is not so much about the sexual intimacy in a given moment. It's about the whole holistic approach to sex. And I've heard many women say that, you know, after time, they're just kind of bored with sex. It's not as attractive for them. For men, on the flip side, it's actually a really important way in which they communicate. It's a way of expressing the intimacy. And for men, it's a much more targeted part of the way that they live out their sexuality. This is just anecdotally talking with couples in marriage counseling. So that makes perfect sense that there would be yeah. less sexual activity for lesbian couples because it's not as important for them. They might feel, you know, the closeness and the intimacy by having a candlelight dinner or something like that. Whereas for men, it is more the sexual act.
Yeah. Well, back to the original point, though, it's, you know, we shouldn't be comparing ourselves with apes.
No, we're very different. Yeah. And it's not just on the genetic level, on the psychological level. I mean, what I see is that we need stability within relationships. And I was just talking this morning with a gentleman who's struggling in his marriage and his wife is asking for a divorce. And the guy he's a wreck. You know, it's been so painful for him. And it's destabilizing everything in his life. And it's just destabilizing her life as well. And so from a psychological standpoint, we need stability within relationships to meet the real underlying needs of the human person.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Clinical psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi, who can be heard daily here on The Quest at 1 p.m., is a father of 10 and asks in his new book, Family Faith Under Fire, whether society's new sins are smoking and having too many kids.
Hmm.
He quotes a pregnant mother of 5 who is amazed at how people disparage her family size and how she's reluctant to tell anyone she's expecting a 6th child.
Right.
And I can tell you from personal experience that when my wife and I announced to our friends that we were expecting our 4th child after a 6-year gap between our 3rd, I universally got attaboys and backslaps. But then a year later, when we announced we're having our 5th, it was crickets and whispers of those guys are weird. A standard objection against having children nowadays is how can you afford them? Yet mm-hmm. in all of human history, no society has ever enjoyed our standard of living and level of resources. My mother was one of 12 children, and I remember one summer driving through the wretched state of New Jersey, and I'm allowed to say that because I was born there.
Wow, that's a pretty strong language. Yes, I hope no one from New Jersey is listening to us.
As we drove past the exit for her house where she grew up, I happened to look up the address on Zillow, and I was stunned by the square footage of the house, which was, remember, it was 12 kids, right. which was 1,500 square feet. They had mm-hmm. one bedroom for mom and dad with a bathroom, and then one bedroom for the boys, one bedroom for the girls, and they right. shared bathroom. So mm-hmm. up until this generation, that's how families live throughout
that's
history.
Right.
So I know you grew up in a similar way. So it's, what are your thoughts
we
about
were
this
kids
being
in my family? And we grew up and we had a 3-bedroom house and we had a bedroom for the boys and bedroom for the girls. And we had a king size bed. And, you know, I think there were 3, maybe even 4 of us little boys sleeping in that king size bed growing up. And we had, I think we had 1.5 baths. So we had one bathroom that had a shower in it and another bathroom was just, you know, a toilet and sink. And we survived. I know it was tough, especially because, you know, I had 2 sisters and they would hog the bathroom time.
Right.
But, you know, tongue in cheek. But, you know, I think you're onto something, Chris. Our standard of living, our expectations is oftentimes what causes the problem. You know, people tell me that, oh, yeah, we can't handle it. My dad's annual salary at that time was a fraction of what some of the people here are making. I mean, he was making below poverty level and we were fine. We didn't die. I wasn't scarred for life. I actually grew up and I think some of the challenges, learning how to work, helping to provide, you know, from some of my own things growing up was good. I learned maturity and I learned the value of hard work. I learned the value of money. So there's so many lessons you learn from that. And this gravitating towards comfort and having more money, it's not necessarily
well, another
making our
big
kids any
factor
better.
Which didn't exist in your or my generation is club and travel sports. I mean, you used to play rec ball with your friends that cost nothing.
Right.
And you played it locally.
Or you played it on the street. You
know? Right. But now everybody's forced, they feel, to
travel
pay
sports.
Enormous amounts of dollars to play in these travel sports year round. Right. And, you know, their kids, of course, invariably get injured from over
and
you know,
then that gets even
repetitive
more expensive.
Use. Yeah, exactly. So, man. You know, we do this to ourselves. But regarding the smoking angle.
The other sin.
Yeah, sin. So I remember you and I were talking about this, and I forwarded you an email that I had just gotten from right. one of my residents at one of the apartment buildings that I own. They were complaining about people smoking cigarettes in the parking lot. Never mind the fact that there's another resident who sits in their apartment all day long and smokes dope, and the whole place stinks because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never once, this kid's been there for years, never once gotten a single complaint. But if you
not a single one.
No.
Really?
But if you start smoking tobacco.
Interesting.
Here come the emails.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, it's you mentioned the new sins of smoking and having too many kids. I think it's important for us as a society to step back and say, what do we truly value? What's truly important? And at the end of life, there's a great study that came out from a couple of professors from Harvard University. It's called The Good Life. And they analyze what makes people happy. And what leads to a happy life is not more money, financial security, or smoking dope. What leads to a happy life is relationships, meaningful relationships. And what more meaningful relationship can there be of that of giving life to children, raising them up, and then enjoying grandchildren later on in life? Those are the deepest joys that I see in people.
Scott Adams, the 68-year-old comic book creator of Dilbert, announced just before he died that he converted to Christianity.
Ah, interesting.
The Dilbert cartoonist had been suffering from terminal prostate cancer.
Right.
And he appeared to invoke what is known as Pascal's Wager, which is an argument about the risks of not following Jesus articulated by the 17th century French Catholic philosopher Pascal. Pascal argued that accepting God can lead to eternal life if he exists, with little risk if he doesn't, versus rejecting God could lead to eternal damnation if he exists and does not yield any benefits if he does not. So
right.
Some online commentators have suggested his conversion is not genuine because he seems to be doing it merely as a wager in case God exists. What are your thoughts about this?
I think, you know, God is working out our salvation any way that he can. And he will extend his mercy upon those who make an effort to come closer to him. So I don't see it as disingenuous. I think it's an intelligent move on his part. So blessed be God. And thanks be to God for his mercy that he extends it to a man like Scott Adams at the end of his life. I think that's oftentimes the pedagogy of, you know, of what God is doing through our suffering, that he is bringing us to a recognition of our own impotence, our own short-lived humanity, that we're going to die. And when we start to face the deeper questions, you know, Pascal's wager comes into focus.
Well,
it makes a lot of sense.
Is it akin to partial contrition in confession versus full contrition?
I think that's a good comparison.
Okay. So, yeah. You know, however you get into the boat, whatever your reasons for getting in the boat, get in the boat.
God's going to work any way that he can to bring about our salvation. And if he can just get us across the finish line, okay, maybe we'll spend a lot of time in purgatory working out our purgation from our sins, but he's getting us there.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Peggy Noonan of the Wall Street Journal published a piece on Christmas Eve about music. She relates a conversation she had years ago with opera singer Beverly Sills about music and how they agreed that it doesn't have to have a purpose, but that deep down, Peggy, this is, deep down, she knew differently. She elegantly states that she knows in her heart that music is a stairway to God, just like science is a stairway too, as are all the arts. And at the top of the stairway is truth, and the truth is God. I think that was elegantly stated by her. So first, thoughts about that.
I think it can be a stairway to God, but music can also be a highway to hell, as we know from AC/DC. Because music reflects and it moves the emotions of the person. And it can move it towards God. It can move us towards dark things, too. So I wouldn't say that universally and necessarily music
is leading us to God. No, but I mean, we know when we're listening to beautiful music.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And beauty is akin to truth.
That's right. Beauty is one of the universals. So, you know, it's one truth, good beauty. It is a reflection of God.
All right. She goes on to say,
by the way, Peggy Noonan is a great writer.
Yeah.
I love her. I mean, she was a speechwriter for Ronald Reagan, and I've read a number of her works, and she always has some really brilliant insights.
Yeah. So she relates how she was telling an LA songwriter about how she likes all kinds of music, but sometime around 2005 or so, she stopped absorbing new music and wondered why. Hmm. Astonishingly, the songwriter immediately said that he experienced the same thing, and he had an answer, as he said that popular musicians stopped doing melody around then. So they did other things like keeping the rhythm and beat, but they started pushing aside melody. And by that, I mean that melody is something that is both thought and felt, whereas just rhythm and beat is felt. Melody is both thought and felt. And so think mm-hmm. of, if you want an example of the song from John Mellencamp, Little Pink Houses, or Born in the USA by, mm-hmm. by Springsteen. These elicit some, you know, thoughts that come with the song, not just the beat that you're feeling when you're playing
right.
it. Right. So some would say that the decline started with the rise of rap, and others would say that music has become a commodity instead of an art, as evidenced by AI generated mm-hmm. songs that now run to the top of a Billboard list. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts about melody?
Well, I would posit, you know, another possible explanation of their lack of capacity to absorb new music after 2005. It's also reflected by age of a person. There's a certain stage in life where you stop interiorizing and learning new things.
Yeah, and that's what Peggy Noonan thought it was okay. until she started talking to this songwriter who was younger than her, and mm-hmm. he had, you know, a different answer. That's mm-hmm. why this article was written.
I don't know. I don't follow popular music enough to really have a strong opinion on it. I think it's plausible. In my community, Father John Klein, he is helping out in chaplaincy at Georgia Tech and works a lot with college students. And he plays music and leads a group called the RC Music Collective. And so we talk a lot about music, and he likes to generate these AI music on his phone. He's got the app that does that, and it's a lot of fun. And some of the music is actually really good, and he puts in some guiding points for it. And he'll do funny things, like one of the priests in my community, he was preaching a little bit too long in his homilies. So Father John created with AI this really funny song about, you know, Father Augustine, who goes on and preaches too long in his homilies. And it's really funny and catchy. Yeah. So I don't know.
I think there is some truth, though, to rap. I don't know that rap is definitely more about the, and I know you're an avid listener of rap.
Actually, to be honest, I did like rap. It was one of my favorite genres growing up when I was in high school.
Okay.
You weren't expecting that, were you? I actually do like rap.
But I do think that it's more about the beat, right, rather than some, you know, inspiring feelings that they that
totally
it
agreed. Yeah, and Aristotle talks about this in his Poetics. He talks about how certain types of music, which appeal to the base part of the human person, that it's just about the beat, and it does elicit certain reactions and bodily movements.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. An article from the St. Paul Center asks, how can angels and demons fight if they don't have bodies? Since angels and demons are pure spirits, they cannot experience physical harm. This means that when angels and demons fight one another, their combat must take a different form than what material beings would experience. The Book of Revelation tells us that a third of the angels in heaven joined Lucifer in his revolt against God when they realized God's plan for humanity involved taking a creature that is lower in the order of beings, i.e. humans, who are below angels, and making them the crux of the salvation plan through worship of the God-man, Jesus, and the particular role Our Lady was destined to play as the devil's counterpoint. Exorcist Father Jose Antonio Fortea offers insight as he tells us, angels are spirits, so their battles must be purely intellectual. The only weapons they can use are intellectual ones. So angels and demons do battle over human beings, and while they don't have direct access to man's higher powers of intellect or will, they are able to help or hinder us by using their outsized intelligence to guide our intellects and shape our imaginations. Angels do this to help us to salvation. Demons do it to drag us to hell. So, for example, a demon may stir up a temptation that one's guardian angel might counter with a memory of their mother, say, to deter them from an act that would otherwise be scandalous to her. So what do you think about this concept of angels and demons fighting each other intellectually?
Well, I think there's actually another way that they fight. So let's stick with that for just a moment. Do they fight intellectually? Yes, because it's through the level of ideas and concepts and things. But they also fight vicariously. And what do I mean by that? Let me use an example. Like in, let's say that a couple is getting, they're getting into marital struggles and they start getting into like proceedings for a divorce. You'll see sometimes, they will leverage their children to fight against their spouse. They'll try to turn them. And I think that the devil does the same thing. The way that he gets at God, the way he fights against God, is indirectly by harming us who are God's sons and daughters. So he hurts God by hurting us. He gets back at God by getting at us.
Right, but we always see on the prayer cards, the prayer to St. Michael the Archangel, you invariably see wrestling pose with Satan. And mm-hmm. So how did he
That's
toss
our
him?
Anthropomorphic way of looking
right,
at things.
Right, but how did he throw him out of heaven if it was on a purely intellectual level?
Well, they're pure spirits, so they don't have bodies. So their spirit is cast out from the presence of God. I don't know.
And what about the scripture quote about, I saw one
fall like lightning.
Like lightning.
Yeah, Jesus says that. I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. A fall can be also a figurative fall. You know, a person falls from grace. They didn't just fall off a building. Fall from grace is like they were elevated in our mind as a great, model of virtue. And then all of a sudden we hear something that they did and like, oh man, gosh, my appreciation of that person has just diminished.
All right. Well then what about this notion that angels can take the form of something temporal? I always think of Padre Pio's guardian angel who would appear in the form of a dog
right.
That was always
mm-hmm.
with him. Mm-hmm. So what about this? Cause these temporal forms could then physically fight.
Mm hmm. Yes, they could, and actually there are cases of that, interestingly, and when you get into demonology and the realm of exorcisms where demons will inhabit objects, they'll throw things across a room, they'll go into animals, they go in possession to human beings, and then it leverage them to fight, to do battle, to do evil things in the world. So again, that goes back to the point of the devil doesn't have a body. And so he has to either inhabit others or manipulate others who do have bodies in order to fight and to cause evil in this world. So, yes, there's the intellectual battle, the spiritual battle, if you will. But then there's the manipulation through instruments as well.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
In addition to smartphones and the access they provide to social media causing harm to young people's mental health, ophthalmologists are raising alarms about an epidemic of childhood myopia. While genetics play a role, spending more time focusing on things up close, whether reading books or watching YouTube videos, significantly increases the chance of nearsightedness.
Mm-hmm.
Studies have found that the more time kids spend outdoors, the less likely they are to become nearsighted, as sunlight stimulates the release of dopamine in the eye, which slows the lengthening of the lens, which causes myopia.
Interesting.
The incidence of myopia is highest in Southeast Asia, possibly due to the heavy cultural emphasis on academics, where an estimated 80% of students who complete 12 years of school are myopic. Rates in the U.S. are lower at 41% in urban areas and 16% in rural areas.
16%?
16%
in rural. That much lower?
That much lower.
Wow, that's very significant.
Why? Because you're outside.
Interesting.
A surge in pediatric myopia prompted governments in Taiwan, China and Singapore to limit screen time for kids and recommend that schools increase time students spend outdoors. One ophthalmologist describes how children spending long periods looking at phones suppresses blinking. And when you don't blink, you don't milk the gland in your eyelid that creates teardrop oil, and it can dry up permanently. Atrophy in this gland has been linked to increased cognitive decline risk, raising the possibility that today's youth may face higher dementia rates as they age. So there's so many reasons to ban smartphones for kids. Here's yet another. What are your thoughts?
Wow, that's really fascinating. I love the science on that. Very, very interesting. I think the solution is pretty simple.
Yeah.
Get kids outside. Get them out of all the screens. I think I shared with you before, I was visiting a city, the center part of the United States. I think it was in Louisville or somewhere like that. No, it was a smaller city. And I was preaching a retreat. And during the whole time I was there, I went outside. I went for a walk, went to go for a run. And during like 2 hours that I was outside, on all these streets, parks that I went by, didn't see a single kid except for one lonely, like maybe 13-year-old boy who was riding his bike alone. And I was like, how are all this was on a weekend, it was a Saturday. How are all the playgrounds abandoned? We need to get kids outside. They just need to be kids, have fun. And when they're in touch with nature, with the reality of creation, it just, there's so many good things that happen.
Or even just, when's the last time you saw a pickup basketball game in a driveway or kids playing football on somebody's front lawn?
It's really rare.
It never happens anymore.
Well, it happens now and then, but it's a lot rarer. Well, anecdote. I was with my family over Christmas and the New Year. My nieces and nephews, they were outside playing around. And it was great to see. And they were so happy just being outside and playing. And my brother, one of the reasons he moved, he was living in Baton Rouge, and he moved to a little hobby farm outside of town so that his boys could just be outside more.
Yeah.
And they are happier, they're healthier when they're outside playing around, building forts and doing stuff.
I read a follow-up today, actually, in the Wall Street Journal about Australia, you know, which last month imposed the ban on social media for teens.
Really? I hadn't heard that.
Right. So Australia and Denmark, by the way, have these bans. And okay. So this was a 1 month follow up, and they were quoting, you know, different kids. One girl was saying, yeah, since I normally would come home and do Snapchat videos, I didn't have any access to that. So what did I do? I went for a run. Shocking.
Amazing. Gosh, it would deal with so many of our societal ills today.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crossed Wires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.